Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Thank you so much to those of you who are joining us live right now on April the 3rd, talking about what the U.S. is doing with its new tariff policy and how Europe can respond. We have with us today three of Bruegel's finest trade experts. We have Ignacio Garcia Becerro, who used to be a top trade official at the European Commission. We have Uri Dadush, who has written several fabulous books about trade policy. And Nicolas Poitier, who has been working on these issues, and particularly economic security here at Bruegel. Nicolas, can you set the stage for our listeners, both live and also in future? What exactly happened?
Yeah, I think it is hard to grasp the severity of the situation. I think this is very much a historical moment for the U.S. economy also, but the global trade system as well. So we have seen tariffs put by the United States on virtually every country in the world. These tariffs range from 10% for the lower tier countries, the countries that U.S. considers not to be too unfair to itself. Up to now, we see for China, 76% of tariffs will be the average tariff rate that will be applied. So really a huge range of tariffs, very high tariffs, and all of them, of course, incompatible with WTO rules, kind of breaking the most basic principle on which our global trading system is based. I'm sure we come back to that in later on. So I think it's important to understand how we end up here. So President Trump, He complains that U.S., which is one of the richest countries on earth, was treated unfairly by all the other countries, including countries that are much poorer than the United States, and all of them have taken advantage of the U.S., and therefore it is justified for the U.S. to kind of use these tariffs to kind of level the playing field again in favor of the United States so this becomes fair. It says, Donald Trump claims, that this, what he calls reciprocal tariffs, are due to unfair trade practices such as tariffs, such as VAT, such as non-market barriers to entry. However, it should be noted that there's a lot of things where I think virtually every trade economist or trade lawyer would say a lot of the things you are mentioning are actually not really trade barriers in that sense, especially VAT. But it should be even, I think what really shows the bizarreness of the situation, how thin this argument is that the United States doesn't even use these arguments when calculating the tariffs. So we have this huge range of tariffs that are calculated based on the bilateral deficit of the United States with each individual country, and it weighs these deficits by the actual volume of trade. And this is how it comes up with a number, which it says is the number, a percentage number, how unfairly this country treats the U.S. For Europe, this is 39%. And then basically it halves this number, saying, oh, look how generous we are, and ends up with half of the tariff as the baseline tariff rates. These tariff rates are applied in the case of China on top of other tariff rates that were already applied. So we have a 34% tariff rate for China that comes on top of the two 10% tariffs that were announced this year, on top of the tariffs that come from Biden last year, and on top of the tariffs that Biden maintained that came from the first Sino-US trade war, where we now arrive at a tariff rate for China of 76%. I think it should be said that the level of tariffs for anyone that is familiar with trade law and the kind of differentiation between countries is utterly bizarre. For the first reason that there are some countries that are considered open to trade that still have very high tariff rates that will be applied now, for the simple reason that they have bilateral deficits. And bilateral deficits for an economist don't mean very much because a lot of trade is indirect. You might export an input that you get from another country through another country to the U.S. and that will show to the detriment of the country that is the last station of the value chain to the U.S. We have countries like Argentina that are infamous for their difficult trade practices, for the high barriers and protectionism, that because they don't have a bilateral trade deficit with the U.S., they end up at 10%. The EU is at 20%, which is kind of in the middle of the road. However, it's kind of curious that, for instance, UK is lower. It's at 10%. And not because UK does anything else, not even because UK has done like good negotiations or has good relationship with the US, but simple for the fact that the UK has a lower bilateral trade deficit with the US than Europe. And the UK, it should be noted here, despite Brexit, has virtually the same regulatory environment still as the EU. The same is true for Switzerland, which has a higher rate than Europe. that still is part of the single market and for most goods is virtually in the same regime as the EU. So I think all of this, it is a bit of a farce. It increases dramatically the rates of tariffs that the US puts on the rest of the world. And it again engages the US with the trade with the rest of the world. I think one last point, I think that we will hopefully touch later on in the discussion. It is not just an economic shock, but it's also a geopolitical shock. Some of the highest tariff rates, around 40%, are on East Asian countries. And these are countries which the US for years has trying to convince that they should not fall into the Chinese sphere of influence, that they should not accept Chinese investments, that they should basically follow the US lead on many policy areas. And now they are now hit with very high tariffs. And of course, these tariffs, and I think we'll discuss this later on, will largely be also paid by US consumers.
Thank you very much for that overview. For our U.S. listeners, VAT is value-added tax. It is a consumption tax that is paid by everyone. So a tariff is traditionally something that is paid by people who are importing goods, as opposed to a tax that is paid by people who are doing a thing. It's not a border-related transaction. So that makes it very interesting, just because countries have chosen to do their sales taxes in a different way from the way the U.S. does, that suddenly this is now part of the trade discussion. Ignacio, we are sitting here in Brussels. We're very lucky to be here in person today. What can Europe make of this? These supposedly take effect immediately. When do we see the impact, and what do we do?
Well, this is actually supposed to start, I think, already Friday for the 10% and Monday for the rest. So, yes, it is the highest tariff hike ever in the history of the United States, much higher than the Smoot-Hawley in terms of increase, actually to a level which is comparable to that of Smoot-Hawley, the tariff increase that was supposed to have provoked or have contributed to the Great Recession, and it is going to be introduced from one day to the other. So this is huge. I mean, in terms of the economic impact, this cannot be in any way underestimated. And by the way, this is just part of accumulation of actions. Let's not forget that we already had the 25% on steel and aluminium, the 25% on cars and car parts. There has been clear indication that there would be also similar type of tariffs on the pharmaceutical products, on the semiconductors. So we are going to really have a huge tariff vault introduced by the United States with a huge economic impact on the whole of the world. So I think this is certainly huge in terms of the impact that is going to have on the European Union. That's why I think it will be critical that the European Union prepares a response which is robust. Now, I have to say that the other thing which for me is not at all clear is there any real scope for negotiating this issue with the United States? Because it seems to me that, for instance, they are not going to accept to lower tariffs below 10% in any event. That has been applied to absolutely every country, probably also for revenue-raising reasons. And they are not going to accept to lower tariffs on the sectors that they really wanted to protect. So the potential to actually try to get to a better situation through negotiations, I have to say that I'm a little bit skeptical about how far that is going to be possible. Obviously, I understand that we have to be discussion with the United States, although I also understand that the European Union would not want to go to that discussion without having to develop a good, credible response. And the other point which I would want to emphasize is that it cannot just simply be a bilateral response. I think it would be critical that the European Union works with other countries which are impacted from those studies, and they try to coordinate policies to try to maintain as much of a possible of a coalition that wants to preserve as much as possible rule-based trade. I think this is really critical at the moment in time. Otherwise, we may actually enter into a very hard-to-control spiral of trade restrictive actions.
Uri, is this the end of the multilateral trade order?
Thanks, Rebecca. First of all, I agree with very much with what Nicholas and Ignacio said, for sure. With this move, historical move, the United States has undermined, in a fundamental way, the WTO non-discrimination principle. It has also broken its most important, actually all, its bilateral trade agreements, beginning with the extraordinarily important USMCA, which Trump negotiated it has also dismissed a very important historical principle in trade relations, which is special and differential treatment for poor countries. And that's how you end up with a 46% tariff on Madagascar, which I know quite well, and which is one of the poorest countries in the world. So as far as the United States is concerned, this is the end of the rules-based trading system. Of course, it's been a long time coming, but this will remain as a symbolic day, a little bit like Pearl Harbor, you know, December 7th, 1941, I think it was. It's a symbolic day, and in addition to undermining the multilateral trading system, as Nicholas correctly mentioned, this is also a blow to the geopolitical order that the United States has established. And especially striking is some of the very high tariffs on the East Asian countries that are precisely the ones, and that would include Japan, it would include Vietnam, etc., that are the countries that are closest to, geographically closest to China, the geopolitical rival of the United States. So the implications of this are easy to draw. The final point I want to make is to agree with Ignacio that the idea that the EU will negotiate its way out of this reciprocal tariff is unfortunately unrealistic. That's my view anyway. And it's unrealistic because everything that Trump has done and what he said yesterday in Rose Garden points to the fact that he wants the tariffs, that he believes in the tariffs, that he needs the tariffs for revenue purposes, and that the calculation, which has no basis in economic theory whatsoever, the calculation on which the reciprocal tariff is based is fantasy. I mean, it's essentially designed to cater to the beliefs of the President of the United States that the most important single indicator of whether you gain from trade is the bilateral trade surplus or bilateral trade deficit. This is a formula well known in business. It's about profits, but bilateral trade balances are not about profit. They're about gain-gain, win-win relationships in the exchange of products and services. Stop there.
Thank you, Uri. It's good to remember that an economy is based on supply and demand. For every person who wants to sell something, someone needs to buy it or the whole system falls down. Nicholas, when will we know what is happening? How quickly can these tariffs start being charged or start collecting revenues? Is revenue collection part of the system here? And what are the instruments the EU has to respond? Ursula von der Leyen has said that the European Commission will consider all of the instruments at its disposal. Can you just walk us through the types of tools available?
So maybe starting with the timeline. So we had a different number of tariffs that have been announced. Some will have effect now, basically. I think when it comes to the effects of these tariffs, this will be some of will be effective immediately. So we already seen markets reacting, S&P 500 being down, the US dollar depreciating, which is kind of like the opposite of what you would expect normally, which shows how much of a break in the kind of mind of markets this is, that this is not a normal tariff. This is really like a change in how the US reacts with the rest of the world. If you look at trade models, we have some indicators of what would be kind of the medium-term effect, and we might come back to that later. But here, I think the short-run effects are the one that are most difficult to estimate.
So just physically, someone doing something today is going to pay more already. Is the process in place to collect that money or take that cost into account?
I mean, I think this is why we've seen a lot of businesses like stopping investment, because basically, even if you are a hard-nosed investor that doesn't care about geopolitics, that doesn't care about any of the goals of these tariffs or any of the reasons why we here might oppose these tariffs, you don't know how to calculate, like how to calculate the value of a business if you do not know which tariff will be applied. And we now have some certainty, but not really that much, because basically we've seen with the tariffs that Trump put on Mexico and Canada, how much he flip-flopped. So I think this is just, there's just so much uncertainty still in the system. There's a lot of uncertainty about how markets will react to this, what will be the economic outcome. There's a number of estimates, but the range is large. And I think there's also all the second round effects, which we cannot really foresee right now. This is a stagflationary shock. So this is a shock that dramatically increases prices for everything that's imported into the U.S. economy. And I think we all know from going to the department store that there's made in Vietnam, made in China, made in Bangladesh is on virtually every product. And virtually every product of these products will now face 30, 40, 70% tariff. So this is immediately. Then at the same time, inputs into U.S. production will become more expensive. Companies will become less competitive. We see less investment. All of this is a contractionary shock for the economy. And then it's the question, how does the Fed react in this situation? Do they prioritize inflation, meaning raising interest rates, which would then contract the economy even further, or do they prioritize economic development? All of this uncertainty really kind of deters investment and makes calculations for any business very difficult, which is why it's very hard to say what will be the immediate effect. We have some kind of baseline models to tell us, okay, in a year, over the medium term, what might be the effect. But I think the short run is very hard to predict.
And tools for Europe?
So tools for Europe, there is basically a strategic decision at this point. So the normal thing you would do is to react to tariffs with tariffs of your own, of a commensurate size. This is what we've done in Europe when it came, for instance, to the steel aluminium tariffs, where basically the Commission has announced a package that was designed to ease the pain of these retaliation package for European consumers and businesses, but maximize the political pain for Trump's constituencies and his voters to increase the pressure to basically lift the tariffs eventually. This doesn't work for tariffs of this scale. So it's very hard to, because it hits everything at 20%, and it's really hard to now kind of engineer that in such a way, and especially since the EU has a trade deficits on goods with the United States. So the idea is here to go beyond the traditional trade measures and to go into services and use new ideas, innovative ideas on services. And one way you could do that is to invoke the anti-coercion instrument, which allows the EU basically to act on virtually every policy measure that is within the EU competency against a case of what the EU calls economic coercion. And here, this instrument has never been applied, and it's also not super clear how it could be applied on certain services. But I think this is the big strategic decision, how the EU will now react. Von der Leyen has been on a speech on I believe, Tuesday, very clear that she wants to do something on services. So I think it's yet to be seen what this will look like exactly, but I think that's something we'll see.
The anti-coercion instrument is so interesting because it was brought into being in a time when the trade issues were very tailored and very specific. We saw very specific cases of one sector in one country, and now we're looking at economic coercion possibly across entire economies. It's just a whole nother way of thinking of things. Ignacio, please tell us your views both on the economic effect and the prices, as Nicholas was saying, and also on the EU's options.
Yeah, well, perhaps I wanted to start by mentioning something that Nicholas said about you going to a shop and finding that so much stuff is made in Vietnam, outside the United States. I say that because it gives you a very clear indication of what is the objective that this administration is pursuing by the tariff. I was listening yesterday to a video that was prepared by the White House to explain the rationale behind the tariffs. And Steve Miller, the deputy head of cabinet of President Trump, was basically saying that in the 50s, if you actually went to a shop in the United States, all the stuff would be made in America. In the 80s, about 50% of the stuff would be made in America. Now you hardly find anything which is made in America. This has been the result of the policy being followed throughout the 20th century. So there's a very clear objective to go back to the tariffs of the 30s. And now President Trump has decided to reverse that, so that all the stuff can be actually be made in the United States. That is the policy, and that's why I have to say I agree with Uri. It's going to be extremely difficult to negotiate something that brings the United States back from this catastrophic type of economic policy has decided to choose. This is something which I think Europe needs to be very, very conscious, which it decides what is the reaction that it needs to take. I think that there will have to be a response. If you don't respond to this type of situation, then you don't exist anymore. So I think, in my view, this will be discussed, I'm sure, with trade ministers on Monday, because there's going to be a meeting of trade ministers. I would imagine that there will be, first of all, confirming the response to the steel and aluminium tariff, which will come into place by the 15th of April. I would also expect that very soon there will be a list of retaliation on the car sector, which probably would still be based on the enforcement regulation, because it's a very similar type of situation as the one which prevailed in steel. But I think there will be a real discussion. I don't know, but there will already be a decision. I think there will be a real discussion about the activation of the anti-coercion instrument, because if you actually look at the policy, this is coercion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you actually have what is the rationale for these reciprocal tariffs? There's a lot of stuff that the United States doesn't like in the policies of their countries, going from the tariff to the VAT, to the fact that your consumption is lower than the United States, that is apparently an unfair trade practice, it's consuming less of your GDP than the United States. And all of this stuff justifies applying a very high tariff, but you can lower the tariff if you give to the United States things that they want. So I think, in my view, this falls within the definition of coercion, although I would agree with you, we are really talking here about coercion vis-a-vis most countries of the world and throughout the economy. So it's a huge amount of coercion which is actually involved. So that's going to be a little bit of a difficult issue to decide how to move forward. But quite frankly, I think this should be a discussion that also takes place very soon, because in my view, you need to be able to react. Although I would emphasize again, it cannot just simply be a pure bilateral reaction. It would be really be critical that the European Union makes a real diplomatic effort to work with other countries. The geopolitical impact on the Indo-Pacific has been huge. I think this will, in my view, very justify that the European Union discuss with countries in the Indo-Pacific how to try to actually coordinate policies to ensure that we can keep as much as possible a rule-based trading system, even if we know that the United States currently is not part of a rule-based trade. And that's something which I would develop a little bit further in a little paper which I will be publishing, I think, tomorrow in Bruegel.
Yes, you can find all of our research and commentary on our website, Bruegel.org. Uri, for so long, we have measured economic success largely through domestic consumption. We've said to China, you need to increase your consumer demand. We've said to Germany, increase your consumer demand. The United States has historically done very well with consumer demand, in part because it was able to buy cheap stuff from all over the world, and that has improved standards of living. This turns all of that on its head. What can we expect for standards of living?
So the effect of these tariffs on the United States will be more important than on most other countries. And this is most other countries. And this is mainly because it's the United States that's imposing the tariffs on the whole world, and it's likely to be the whole world or some significant subset that will retaliate against the United States. So, for example, for the European Union, only about 2% of European Union value added as a share of GDP is oriented towards the United States. So there is actually a limited amount in terms of aggregate effects and effects on EU consumption that the tariffs of the United States, even at 20%, can have on the European Union, even though it'll have a bigger effect on some sectors. In the case of the United States, it's addressing the whole imports of the United States, which are somewhere in the, or imports of goods, which are somewhere in the vicinity of, I don't remember exactly, but close to 15% of US GDP. So if, as some people have calculated, the aggregate tariff now goes up by 20 percentage points, you're talking about a direct hit in terms of prices, if the prices are simply passed on to European consumers, of about 3% relative to GDP, and a bigger number relative to consumption, which is about 70% of GDP. So there's going to be a significant one-time, I stress, one-time price increase in the United States if these tariffs are fully implemented. And that is perhaps the single biggest source of the backlash that will be coming against the Trump administration for this measure. The other big backlash source is that somewhere in the region of half or more of the imports of the United States take the form of raw materials and parts, only some of which are exempted from the tariff. And that will have a big effect on some U.S. businesses, many U.S. businesses that depend on imports. And that's where the second backlash is going to be. The third backlash, which will be global again, is insofar as other countries retaliate, and that is why it is important to retaliate, several U.S. exporters are going to be affected. You put all of that together, and this is going to be a significant hit on the United States. As Trump himself recognizes, this is the short-term pain. And the big question, which I'm not going to go into now, is whether actually there's going to be a long-term gain from this. But the thing that's for sure is that U.S. consumers are going to take a big hit from these tariffs.
You mentioned talking about the short-term consequences of this. How do we think about economic performance, economic indicators, which are backward-looking, and the stock market, which tends to be an indicator of how people think about the future, and yet how the stock market is moving is something that people react to in real time? Do we expect the markets, it's all market psychology, so I realize we don't know, but do we need a market crash to reverse these policies, or do the markets sort of expect that things will work out in the end and try to ride it out? Is the stock market in a bit of a loop where its own performance affects how long these measures stay in place?
Well, you're getting into financial markets, which immediately means a lot of speculation, Rebecca.
Yes,
you know.
I have asked you to try and explain the speculation process, not to predict the levels, but to help us think through what the different players, what their actions mean in this system.
Well, for a start, of course, the markets have already reacted very negatively, the futures markets and overnight markets and the European markets are all down big time today. So they didn't like what they heard yesterday. The interesting question is, what happens, how will they think about the long term after this? As an economist, I have to tell you that the way I think about the long term is that it's not good, very simply because this will reduce the efficiency of the American economy, of the global economy, and reduce competition and incentives to do better in the global economy. However, from the point of view of the stock markets, they're always difficult to read. the U.S. stock market may see in some sectors some benefit from this, because there will be some import substitution. There has to be some import substitution. When you're doing a universal tariff on average 20%, there will be that. My guess, certainly if I was advising, I don't know, a CEO or an investment company, I would say be very careful about what this means for the long-term performance of the US stock market, because we're going to see a lot less opportunities on global markets, and we're going to see a lot less incentives to innovate and become productive. That's the best I can do. You know, I would never cut it as in an investment bank.
Thank you for that. For so many people listening, trying to tease out what the market means, not what it will do, but what it means for the future versus what it means for right now, is a really tough question. Nicholas.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think market performance is clearly linked to the trade deficits in a very direct way. And I think this is, for me, the biggest risks I see in financial markets, is that something really shifts. If something really shifts in the underlying way we conduct business in the world, because the US stops being central, that could have major repercussions on foreign exchange markets from the US dollar, and then in particular also for US stock market performance. The reason that the US runs such a big trade deficit with the rest of the world is that people that earn US dollars from selling stuff to the US prefer to invest them in US stocks because they were performing so well, because US treasuries were basically underlying virtually all business in the world, and the US financial center were in the center of this. If this were to change, if people now stopped trusting the US dollar as kind of the main currency through which they conduct business, if they want to even just to hedge against US dollar because now basically the countries are upset because of these tariffs, things might change. And I'm not saying this is necessarily bound to happen. We had similar discussions in the 2000s when everyone thought that great financial crisis would shift balance of payments and kind of maybe break the current account imbalances we had at the time, and it did never happen, and the opposite happened during the great financial crisis. But there are risks of this sort that I think we should take very seriously, in particular because the chief economic advisor of Donald Trump has written in his infamous paper on the Mar-a-Lago Accord that he considers defaulting on U.S. bonds as an option to devalue the dollar to kind of rebalance the trade balances. And this sort would have major repercussions. So I think it's really hard. I don't want to, Azuri, I don't feel in any way qualified to comment on stock markets, but I think the biggest financial risk is actually not in the movements we see right now, but basically what this means for the financial system going forward.
This advisor also called for gradual tariff moves, so it's unclear how much this rationale is playing into what happens. And also, the dollar can be used outside the U.S. You can still use the dollar as a medium of exchange and a store of value without that money going through the U.S. So currencies are of their own special breed of financial market, even in very difficult times. Ignacio.
Well, I'm not an economist. I'm even less qualified to comment on the markets. But one thing which I think is going to be very interesting is to watch how the dollar evolves, how it reacts to the new tariff measures. Because if you actually read the papers that have been put forward by some of the economists working for the Trump administration, their assumption has been when these tariffs are introduced, the value of the dollar is going to go up. And this is going to compensate for the inflationary impact. If the value of the dollar does not go up but continues to go down, this will probably further exacerbate the inflation. And my sense is that politically this is going to be the big political cost for the current administration. If these policies are being seen as being actually provoking a high degree of inflation in the United States and not contributing to growth because of the whole uncertainty which is being created, hopefully this will have a political impact. Of course, the political impact is not going to be immediate. There's still some time until the U.S. midterms. But it seems to be interesting that some Democrats are also beginning to make the argument that what is currently happening is a huge increase in sales taxes, which are being going to be paid by the U.S. consumers. I think we need to see how this whole picture evolves, the evolution of the dollar, the evolution of inflation, because, as I said, that's what eventually could lead to a correction of this policy, because it's very clear that the objective of this administration is certainly to erect a very high tariff wall to protect the United States.
Now, what are the chances that the exemptions could grow so large so as to effectively nullify the tariffs? Could we end up in a situation where we have these extremely high across-the-board tariffs, and yet we also have so many exemptions that almost no one is paying them?
I've seen that, that's what happened a little bit with the steel and aluminium tariff, because at the same time that those tariffs were introduced, there was a whole complex process of asking for exemption that was really very, very much used. As far as I know, there has been no indication whatsoever that there is a process of exemptions in relation to these reciprocal tariffs. At least I haven't seen that indicated anywhere in the executive order that has been announced by the White House. So my impression at this initial phase is that this is really going to be applied very, very much across the board with no real exemptions. I mean, as I said, maybe what the administration would do if a country is ready to offer some nice concessions, say, okay, I can bring down your tariff 5 percentage points, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of exemptions, I would not count on that.
Ignacio, you are a long-term observer of the World Trade Organization and the general effort to coordinate global trade. How possible would it be right now for the rest of the world to build a trade system without the U.S.? Just suspend the U.S. from the WTO, trade among themselves, work things out among themselves. Would there be a possibility of creating a dynamic economy, or would there be so much dumping and shifting to make up for the lack of the U.S. consumer that it wouldn't work? What do you think?
Well, this is such a profound shock to the system that if in these conditions countries do not react and do not begin to see that they need to try to coordinate a little bit their policies, then is when I would really be worried. This is the end of rule-based trade. It's not just that the U.S. would contract out from rule-based trade, it would be the end of rule-based trade. That's what I think is really going to be important, that the European Union does a real diplomatic effort to outreach to some other countries which are being impacted by this tariff. And I suggest, why don't we start with the CPTPP countries, the key Indo-Pacific countries, and we begin to discuss between ourselves how to try to be sure that, first of all, as among ourselves, we keep rule-based trade, we avoid entering into a protectionist spiral. Secondly, that we all are ready to react vis-a-vis the tariffs. Not everyone is going to be retaliating. I think that's very clear. Some countries will find it more difficult than to retaliate than others. But at the very least, I hope that all countries are ready to take a case in the WTO vis-a-vis the United States tariffs. That would be an important political signal, even if we know that at the end of the day, the United States is going to appeal into the void. But it's a signal that actually those countries believe in the rules and that the rules apply. And certainly that they start to discuss between themselves how to move forward on the WTO reform agenda. Now, I have no expectations of the United States administration at this point in time really being ready to engage in good faith in a discussion about WTO reform. But the important is the political signal, that actually these countries recognize that actually WTO reform needs to be moving forward, that they are ready to engage also with countries in the global south, to talk with countries with Brazil, India, China, of course, also with China, and to try to see how one creates a dynamic to move in the direction of a reform of the global trading system. It's not going to happen in the next 4 years, but you need to be starting to build in the basis to hopefully in the future there might be a different way of engaging with the United States.
Nicholas, what about EU-China relations?
Yeah, so I think this is where it gets complicated. So I think there are two effects. The first one is that this breaks the somewhat coalition that was there before between the EU and the US, where there was a recognition that economic decoupling from China would be ruinous and therefore we won't do it. But we will pursue together a policy of de-risking. There was, of course, different emphasis and there was different policies that not everyone agreed on the way to do it. But there was basically, to some extent, a joint strategy. That's over now. So that coalition is no more. Now the US is pursuing full-out decoupling from China and waging trade wars against everyone else. And the question is then what happens to Europe, no? Like where will Europe position itself? And the reason that Europe was keen on de-risking was not just a form of alignment with the United States, but it was also the recognition that on some points, US was right, that there are real, I mean, the EU agrees on many of the grievances on the US against non-market practices. The EU has seen economic coercion against Lithuania, which is, was one of the main arguments put forward at the time of the anti-coercion instrument was passed. It was kind of really framed as an anti-China instrument at that time. And all of this is still there. So all of these reasons to worry about China for Europe are still there. At the same time, the pressure on Europe to find alternative markets to the United States is higher than ever. US has become a less and less reliable ally in many, many domains. And the question now is basically, does the EU want to hedge against that by rebuilding its improving its relations with China again? But there's another problem here, which is basically that all the things that China used to sell to the US, and not just China, but also all the other countries hit with these very high tariffs, will have to end up somewhere. And a lot of them will end up on the European markets. So the pressure to introduce safeguards against exports from China to the EU will be very high. And this could lead to then secondary trade tensions just as a basic byproduct of the US closing itself off to Chinese exports.
Well, just one term. I totally agree with what Niklas has said. Just to clarify, safeguards vis-a-vis China would not be legal under the WTO. But safeguards is a perfectly legitimate WTO instrument whenever you can actually demonstrate that there is an increase of imports and that that increase of imports is threatening or causing serious injuries to your producers. So that's an instrument which is available under WTO. If there's going to be a risk of diversion into the European market, it's not going to be just China. I think that this is actually huge tariffs which are being applied on many, many, many countries. And I think it would be important that any reaction by the European Union is justified. It is based on the rules of the WTO. And for me, yes, the safeguard instrument potentially is something that might have to be looked at in some cases. But when there's a real evidence that there is actually a real risk of serious injury for the domestic producers.
Is it possible that EU consumers could benefit because things they were importing anyway become more affordable?
There is modeling out there. I mean, we have to take a lot of this with a grain of salt because this is a shock that normally, I mean, the models work well if they see stuff they already seen in the past, right? They calibrate it to past experiences. And we are in uncharted territory, to be very clear on that. But they're modeling that shows a deflationary shock for Europe because prices will go down for many things because there will be less demand for them. How this will kind of play out with everything else is a bit unclear, but there are indicators. Some models show inflationary effects in Europe because we will have to pay more because of retaliation for the US goods. Some of them show deflationary effects because of this trade diversion from China, Vietnam, and so on. Where we will end up, I think I would put money on a deflationary shock, but there might be factors that I don't see.
Uri?
The question, Rebecca?
There are so many things. If there's anything you'd like to comment on, I'd welcome that. But if you're in need of a question, I would be interested in what you think the impact of inflation in the U.S., deflation in Europe, and all sorts of effects in Asia would have on how the world economy is doing.
Well, I think if there is deflation, a deflationary impact in Europe, it will be absolutely minimal, given, you know, what I just said about the importance of U.S. trade in the huge European economy. And of course, if Europe retaliates, there's going to be some inflationary impact in Europe. So anyway, I don't think that's a big part of the story. The big part of the story is how inflation will play out in the U.S. And I think it's going to be bad, Rebecca, because this is a big shock, 20% tariff on imports. We've gone through the numbers. The Fed will react to this. I mean, they're going to delay. Their plan at some point was 3 rate cuts this year, then it became 2 rate cuts, then people now are expecting 1 rate cut only. And I would not be surprised if there are no rate cuts. So, you know, the mortgage rate, I happen to to live there normally, and I'm in Paris now. And the mortgage rates in the U.S. are astronomical. I think 7.5% or something like that, between 7.5% and 8% already. Bear in mind also, we haven't discussed this, but this is a regressive set of measures. By this I mean that the average American, the median American consumer, and certainly below the median, are going to take the direct hit of these high prices. Wealthier Americans, you know, the top 10% that actually account for half of U.S. consumption nowadays, will be able to manage, you know, higher prices on groceries. That's not an issue. It's painful. It's irritating, but it's not a big deal. They'll be much more affected by how the stock market reacts. But the bottom 50% of Americans are going to be badly hit by this. Price of cars is estimated to go up by several thousand dollars, even the cheaper cars. And bear in mind that the main objective on the financial side is to maintain the tax cuts of the first Trump administration and to extend them. So basically, you have a set of policies that reduces the real income of most American consumers, and particularly the poorest American consumers, those who spend a large amount on food and clothes, et cetera, et cetera, and to increase, or at least not reduce, the real incomes of the top 20% or so of Americans. And this, you have to say, is one of the reasons that this set of policies is dubious from a medium-term political point of view. You're already seeing, by the way, some repercussions, because yes, there were two special elections in Florida that the Republicans won. This is in Trump country. However, in both instances, the majority of the Republicans was cut in a very dramatic way. And so it's not difficult to extrapolate that as you go into the midterm elections, which anyway, the history has been that the incumbent administration loses out, as you go into the midterm elections, you're going to get a very strong political reaction to these measures.
Yeah, I want to add on the internal politics of the U.S. I mean, tariffs are prerogative of Congress, and Trump uses an emergency measure to impose a state, declaring a state of emergency to impose tariffs against everyone. So I think there is the real question: if Congress would change his mind and see that this is electoral suicide, there is a world in which eventually they might assert themselves. This is not in this Congress, so I think we're very far away from this. But I agree with Uri, this looks electorally unsustainable. I think how this plays politically in the U.S. is for me, it's one of the most interesting things about this.
I mean, just building on what Niklas said, yesterday there was also this very interesting political development about this vote in the Senate, when there was a majority in the Senate to challenge the determination by United States that there was an international emergency relating to the imports of fentanyl from Canada. And there were still four Republicans in the Senate that were very actively to join the Democrats in that vote. Now, it's a long way between that and having any kind of Republican rebellion against the trade policies of this administration. So I would not really expect anything of that nature happening, at least certainly this side of the midterms. But I think you are beginning to see a certain political movement building up in the United States, that this is really a very aggressive policy, as Uri has said. And if this begins to have a significant impact on inflation, I could see this becoming a big, big issue for the midterm elections.
Trump voters were very concerned about the price of food and the price of housing going into this election. So if food and housing become ever more expensive, that would be an interesting outcome for them to have voted for. Uri, further thoughts?
I mean, look, the main point I will make is that Europeans, this is what the focus is today, have to retaliate. They have to retaliate. First of all, politically, they have to retaliate for domestic purposes. But more importantly, they have to deter Trump from going further than he has already gone. Remember that he's saying he's being very nice to us. Because he's only applying half of the notional tariff. So he has to be deterred. And, you know, tariff negotiations, as my friend Ignacio knows better than I, are very difficult. And it's important that the Europeans accumulate bargaining chips for when, hopefully, the day comes that we reverse in a negotiation these tariff increases. But at the same time, it's important for Europeans to take a long-term view. What relations do we want to have with the United States 10 years from now, 20 years from now? What's for sure is that we don't want the United States as an enemy. We don't treat the United States as an enemy. So that's why it's important to be moderate in the reaction, moderate in the tone, et cetera, et cetera. Trump is a 78-year-old, extraordinarily eccentric man. The United States will be long, will be there for the Europeans and for everybody else long after Trump has gone from the scene. This is not a prediction that American isolationism and protectionism will disappear with Trump. I don't know what it will do, but it's very unlikely to be as extreme and aggressive as it is today. So important to take a long-term view, to retaliate, but not to overreact in a proportionate way. And Europe continues to be highly dependent on the United States for its security. And that's another reason to take it easy.
Ignacio.
No, I just wanted to build a little bit on this point, because I think that, in my view, President von der Leyen made an excellent statement to the European Parliament in advance of the decision that was going to be taken by the United States, where she talked about this three-pronged strategy. First of all, you cannot really enter into any discussion with the United States with being in a position of weakness, so it's absolutely necessary to retaliate and to do it smartly, in a manner that does not impose economic costs on us, but imposes the maximum political cost on the United States. Second, it is a real good opportunity to push forward our diversification agenda in terms of concluding the trade agreements with countries that want to conclude those trade agreements with us. There's a need to also to see how to use this opportunity to reinforce the single market. And I think it was very exciting that apparently there's the intention to have new proposals coming from the Commission in 1 month's time. So it's quite extra fast. But I would really argue there has to be a fourth leg to this strategy. This is an existential moment for the rule-based trading system. It's only the European Union that can lead to create a coalition of countries that care about rule-based trade, that are ready to show that they are willing to act in support of rule-based trade. And I agree with Ulrich. It's very important to recognize that concerns that have been expressed by the United States about the global trading system are recognized as being legitimate, are recognized as concerns on which there's a willingness to engage. I don't really expect this administration to do it, but the United States is broader than this administration.
I appreciated what you said, Uri, about this being a particular moment of very extreme and eccentric views. The U.S. has been through waves of this before in the 1970s, during the Civil Rights Movement, before that. There are times when the U.S. is really struggling to find itself in its core, and the policies get wild. So far, for couple hundred years now, the U.S. has continued as a country and as an economic player, and presumably will in the future. Nicholas, what would you like to see from Europe riding this out? We've got about 5 minutes left in our podcast, so maybe each of you can offer some thoughts on, beyond what Ignacio just said about keeping calm and acting in a way to have maximum impact and minimum damage, but what can Europe do?
Yeah, I agree very much with everything Ignacio said. It is for Europe a keep calm and carry on moment. I also agree that von der Leyen's statement was excellent, like kind of saying, we don't want this trade war, we don't want to get into this conflict, but we have to retaliate, and you do have to retaliate. There's no question about that in my mind. I think it's also important to not freak out, because there will be negative effects on the EU, but as Uri was laying out, the effects will be very much manageable. The biggest effect will be in North America, in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It's very much a self-defeating exercise they're doing. I think for the European Union, all estimates I've seen, yes, it's a negative economic shock, but it's not something like COVID. It's on a smaller magnitude. So we should be able to manage it. And we should be able to mitigate some of these effects by simply getting a house into order. Now is the time to build the single market. Now is the time to actually ratify trade agreements that have been on the shelves for a long time now. So I think this is really a moment to push these things forward. I would like to see that. And I think if we play the cards well, indeed, the best way I could describe what the U.S. is doing is believing, or what Trump is doing is believing his own propaganda, and over leveraging the cards that the U.S. has, and it cannot afford to wage a trade war with everyone, and that will eventually hit it back, and at some point it will have to come back if it doesn't want to end up poorer. The idea that Ignacio was saying, that you have these T-shirts in your store with like a made in Bangladesh label, the idea that the U.S. could do this itself at home and would become more prosperous by, instead of building rockets and writing software code, by sewing T-shirts, that's ludicrous. That will not happen because the wages are so high, but it's also, even to the extent it happens, it will be detrimental for economic growth. So I think this is an erroneous path they're taking. It will take some time for the U.S. to recognize that. Maybe they will never recognize that, but they will pay the price. And now it's for Europe to take the leadership for going forward for the rest of the world.
Well, just simply to add, in my view, this will be a very good moment for President von der Leyen to pass a few phone calls to the Prime Minister of Japan, to Mark Carney in Canada, to Keir Starmer in the UK, to Albanese in Australia, to discuss why don't our trade ministers meet and discuss and strategize what is the best way to coordinate in an intelligent manner the reactions in relation to these tariffs, and to act together to try to, as much as possible, to maintain the rule-based trade among ourselves. Let's look into a meeting of the ministers where these issues can be discussed. And I hope that those countries that have been treated lightly because they have a 10% tariff would not say, we better hide because we think if we start showing our face, we might be hit harder. I hope that that's not going to be the reaction.
Nicholas, I appreciated what you said about building the single market. Europe has been talking for some time about bringing down internal barriers, about strengthening the euro, about fixing up its capital markets so they work better. Now would certainly be a good time to get those going and move forward. Uri, we have 3 minutes left in our podcast. Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like people to take away?
I don't have 3 minutes, but I will just say, Rebecca, one way to think about it is that this is why we built Europe. We built Europe to increase our capacity to operate in a much bigger world economy than we were used to, with much bigger players than any individual countries, whether France or Germany, Italy, etc. And the numbers are clear, which is that the Europeans depend very heavily on selling to each other, And they depend, and they also have a pretty formidable set of international trade agreements, such as the one with Canada, the one with Japan, which the one for many countries in Africa and some in Asia, others in Asia, that give some predictability to the trade relations in a way that I think Europe can count on, and in a way, by the way, that in contrast, the United States can no longer count in its own bilateral trade agreements, simply because it is ignoring all the rules. And it is ignoring all the rules of the multilateral trading system as well. So that we are now in a situation where the exports of the United States are on much more tenuous grounds than they've ever been, because it doesn't observe the rules and others will not observe the rules. The Europeans are in a stronger position.
Thank you for that. Thank you to everyone who has joined us in real time online. Thank you also to those of you who will be listening to the podcast later. Today, we are at Bruegel, The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined by Uri Dadush, Nicolas Poitier, and Ignacio Garcia Becerro. You can find all of our many reports on economic security, on trade, on the future of the multilateral trading system on our website, Bruegel.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.